Well, you've all been so prompt this evening that we might as well start early and have a chance to be answering more of your questions tonight than otherwise would be possible. I want to welcome you to Congresswoman Lois Capps' community information session on comprehensive health insurance reform. My name is Don Maruska. My wife and I live in the community of Los Osos, and I'm a volunteer moderator tonight. And really, my purpose in being here is to help you get as much information from tonight's session as possible and to get as many of your questions, however difficult or hard they may be, answered as possible. So I'm here for you, and I hope that you'll feel that that's the case as the evening unfolds. I especially want to thank all the people who were helpful. There were many people who have been in tonight's session. The United Methodist Church, and being your host this evening, our panelists, Congresswoman Lois Capps, Dr. Rushdie Abdul-Qadir, who is an emergency room physician in Sierra Vista and Twin Cities Hospital, and Joyce Ellen Lippum, who is a director of the Area Agency on Aging. And the League of Women Voters is playing a special role this evening in helping to gather your questions and to make sure that they're answered as fully and completely as possible. So the questions are really in their hands, and they'll be bringing them up for me to ask on your behalf so that those questions come to the panelists as accurately and as specifically as you ask them. And I'd like to especially thank you as the audience for being here this evening, and I want to thank AGP Video that's providing a live video streaming of this on the World Wide Web at slowspan.org, so you can go there and see other pieces of it later, and we welcome that live audience, and there will be opportunities to see that on a recorded basis later in subsequent days. So many opportunities have been created here for this to be a productive event for you, and as I had a chance to greet many of you coming in this evening, I can see the interest and intent that you have for this to be a productive session. I'd like to now ask Pastor Jane Voice, the pastor here at United Methodist Church, to welcome you this evening.
I never say this on Sunday morning, but before we begin, please turn off your cell phones, if you haven't already. It is indeed a joy to have you all here tonight, and something else I rarely need to say on Sunday morning is the sun. We have this fabulous new facility, and we get the experience of the natural world beamed into us in a special way, but especially this time of night, the beaming comes about right that way. So if you want to put your sunglasses on, feel free, because it should be darkening out in about a half an hour or so. And also, we're going to keep our air conditioning going, and so hopefully it'll continue to get ever cooler in our space. So we're here to create an experience of comfort and of love as much as we possibly can. It is perhaps an unusual scenario, an unusual place for us to gather to talk about issues such as this, to come into a church sanctuary to do that. But I was thinking, a sanctuary is a place where every time we come together to worship is a place where we hope people come with the fullness of their hopes and fears and angers and hurts and dreams. And we bring that to this space and we open ourselves up to a presence that we believe is especially here in this place that we call a sacred space, a presence that is about love and is about helping us see things in a new way, helping us see one another in a new way, helping us listen, and experiencing perhaps a healing and a wholeness that transcends whatever we might have brought into this space. And that is left unsaid. May that spirit of love and life live in those words as well. May that spirit of love and life live in our eyes, in our ears, as we look and we listen. May it live in our hearts. And may it surround each one of us, the whole of this space, wherever folks who are watching this meeting, may that spirit of life and love fill and surround you. And may indeed this be a time of great blessing
for the community of San Luis Obispo and the witness perhaps we make for the whole of our country at this time and in this place. Amen. I'd like to invite Representative Capps now to come and share a Pledge of Allegiance.
Please stand and join me in pledging allegiance to our flag. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the Republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you very much. What I want to do is take a moment to give you an outline for this evening's program. There's much heat that's been generated around health insurance reform, but precious little light. And tonight we hope that this will be an enlightening experience for you in two dimensions. And that is, Congresswoman Capps, as an author of many provisions of the Health Insurance Reform Act from the House, is going to give you an overview for about 20 minutes. It's timed. It's not going to be more than 20 minutes. But to really give you a view of what's in the bill, what's there, and how it's certain how it's currently functioning, so that you have a solid base of information about it. We encourage you to write down your questions. One of the ways we thought would be most efficient to get as many questions asked and answered as possible would be to have you write them down, and that's why we've been collecting those questions. The League of Women Voters is responsible and in charge of those questions back there. They're going to organize them by topics and be able to give you a response. I'll be asking your questions on your behalf, and we'll be having the panelists answer. Between Congresswoman Capps and the answering of the questions, though, we'll be having perspectives from our two panelists here that will be giving their viewpoint from people being on the front lines, if you will, of healthcare from different perspectives to offer their points of view. But we're going to be certain that by the time we have to have at least 50 minutes, if not a full hour, to be answering questions. And the reason that you were asked on the question form to put down your name and address is that if your question is not answered this evening, although we're hoping to get to at least all the categories of questions, Congresswoman Capps has promised that if you're in her district, she'll be giving you a written response so that you don't go without the questions being fully answered. She's going to receive all the question cards at the end as well to see exactly what you submitted and exactly the way that you did it. So we encourage you to put your contact information on there. Now, it's also important to the Congresswoman to be knowing what you think about all this. So after you've had a chance to hear more about the legislation, where it is, what's going on, and had an opportunity to hear the perspectives from the panelists and had an opportunity to hear the questions and answers, the answers to questions that you raise and answers to questions that your neighbors have asked, you're invited to take the comment form, which you each have, the full sheet of paper, and to take that form and to write down comments that you'd like and conclusions or points of view that you want to share with the Congresswoman, and be sure to turn those in to the staff at the end, because the Congresswoman really wants to know what your thoughts are about your reflections on this evening's discussion and what you've learned, what you still have questions about, or what you maybe have disagreements. And we certainly want to acknowledge that full spectrum of potential responses that you may have. So that's the basic approach that we're going to use. We hope that that will optimize the information value to you and make this a session that is illuminating rather than just hot and heavy. In that regard, what I want to do is also take a moment to review the code of conduct with you that you saw at the outset. I know from working for 12 years with the community of San Luis Obispo and beyond that this is a wonderful community and you have a very high standard of civil engagement. And I don't anticipate any difficulties this evening, but we just want to be clear about the code of conduct. No signs or banners or posters that would interfere with other people being able to see things. No microphones or other things that would amplify your voice endless, as well. So with that, we're going to begin with a brief presentation from Congresswoman Capps about the detail regarding the legislation, how it works, some frequently asked questions, some things that may be on your mind, and see if we can get some of those initial things. So be sure you can see the screen up there. And I want to introduce Aaron Shapiro, who's going to be working the video. Aaron, where are you? Because if you have, he's way in the back, but if topics come up in the course of your questions, Aaron may be bringing the actual legislation up on the screen for you so you can see how these issues are actually addressed. So we're trying to use media here to help you learn as much as you can from this evening. So Congresswoman Katz, if you please.
Thank you, each of you, very much for coming out this evening. I'm delighted to have this opportunity. I want to add my thanks to Pastor Jane Voights and to this congregation for being so welcoming with your staff, with the use of the space, with the time, and with this wonderful new addition to the community in the form of this worship place. I'm pleased that we have the panelists that we do. You'll be hearing from them. They will add to your knowledge base, I'm sure. And we do have an excellent moderator, don't you think? Don Maruska, thank you very much.
Thank you.
And I want to also add my thanks to the League of Women Voters. We really covet the opportunity to hear from you. And hopefully we'll get through as many questions as we can, but they are very skilled, nonpartisan, a third party. None of our staff will see any of the questions that you hand directly to them, but they know how to sort them into categories so that if your question isn't chosen, someone with a question very similar to yours perhaps is, and therefore your question will hopefully be answered or addressed as well. That's our goal, to get as much opportunity as we can to move the knowledge base that we all want to have about something as important as this legislation is, or as this topic is, I'll put it that way. This is a very, very important topic to each of us because it's personal. Healthcare is something we all know about, personally and with our family and loved ones. So I'm going to make this presentation about the bill using, hopefully, it's a very light lit from the sunlight room, and hopefully you can see some of the comments that are on the screen, which will be following my comments, or will be in sync with each other, I hope. And then we'll have as much time as we can after our panelists also add their comments to the topic to address your questions that you're going to be submitting, if you choose, on the cards. As I said, this is Don Maruska said as well, there's been a lot of attention, particularly lately, paid to this legislation and to the topic. I welcome that. I think this is good. This is the American way of doing things, isn't it? To really become engaged in topics that mean a lot to us, and that our government is seeking to do the right thing on our behalf. And that's some of you may or may not trust that process, but that's the one we have, and we want to make the best use of it as we can. We don't agree on everything. I can tell you that from the outset. I know that. We've been hearing from a lot of you in our office here on Marsh Street and in our other two offices throughout the district. And I'm thankful again that that you take the time to be in touch with us, whether through our website or by phone or by email. I'm going to say at the outset, I believe this is an excellent bill. I don't expect you all to agree with that, but I have worked hard on it. I was proud to vote for it in my committee because this legislation passed through the Energy Commerce Committee on which I serve. So I am eager for you to know the facts about the legislation and in our health reform proposal. I believe also that we can agree on one thing, that we really don't want to continue down the path we are on today with the way we manage healthcare in this country. But for starters, many people here, sitting here this evening, have healthcare coverage that they like. And I do. So if you have coverage now and you like the coverage you have, you can keep it. And our plan will help you keep the cost as low as possible. And I can't say this enough, so I'm going to repeat it because that's really a core principle of our legislation. If you like the coverage of health care that you now have, you can keep it, and our plan will help you to lower the costs. But for 60 years now, our country has been trying to come up with a better way to deliver health care to more people. So we have now come up with a plan to ensure that the health insurance you currently have is always there and affordable, that we get everyone insured, and that we begin to slow down the increase in health care costs. This is our goal, and it's called H.R. 3200, the America's Affordable Health Choices Act. It has passed the three relevant committees in the House of Representatives, and I was proud to vote in favor of it passing out of my committee, the Energy and Commerce Committee. When we return next week to Congress, the bill will come to the floor of the House for debate. And the Senate will also move to pass a bill, which will then need to be reconciled with the House version. Hopefully, we'll have a final bill by the end of this year that the President can sign into law. Now, how will this work? First, as I've said twice already, if you like the insurance you have, you can keep it. Better yet, you'll get benefit from greater protection and lower costs. For example, your insurance company won't be able to cut you from their rolls if you get sick. But we're going to make improvements to help everyone out, and I'm going to go through them in the order on the screen so you can follow along, and please do bear with me. First of all, because health insurance is so important to all of us, we are going to have to share responsibility, each of us, to make it better. Insurance companies will have to stop abusive practices. Employers will have a choice to provide health insurance to their employees that meets minimum benefit requirements, or they can contribute a fee on their employees' behalf to help their employees purchase their own insurance. Analysis by the Congressional Budget Office show that most employers will retain coverage for their employees. Furthermore, we're giving insurance companies a reason to bring down costs to attract more customers into their plans now that everyone has to have one. We'll also provide assistance to small business employers for whom the cost of providing insurance today is way too expensive. For example, small businesses with payrolls below $500,000 a year are completely exempt from this requirement of providing insurance or paying a fee. But don't worry, there'll be help for those workers in these small businesses to buy insurance, and I'll explain that in a few minutes. Similar to car insurance, everyone will have to carry health insurance, and this bill makes it affordable to do so. And this is going to bring down costs for everyone because more people will be paying into the system. And the government will be responsible for keeping health insurance affordable and credible, as well as strengthening Medicare and Medicaid to make sure they operate more efficiently. You know, when I say Medicaid, I mean Medi-Cal as we know it here in California. So where do individuals go if they don't have health insurance from their employer? We will be setting up a national health exchange. It will be ready to go in 2013. Not immediately. It will take a while to get that going. This is basically a market where you go to shop for an insurance plan that best fits your needs and your budget. And this is now for those with no insurance. It will be, at first at least, it will be administered by an independent commission that will make sure that you have access to affordable health care. In this exchange, you'll be able to choose from either a public option or among many private insurance plans. And the government will provide subsidies to help some people afford this insurance. For example, a family of four with an income under $88,200 a year would qualify for some financial assistance. Costs of health care are that high. Every plan operating in the package will have to meet what is called an essential benefits package. A committee led by the Surgeon General will determine the minimum benefits every plan has to offer as part of its coverage. And from there, the plans will have options to add additional benefits, and you will have options to purchase more robust benefit packages if you choose. The absolute minimum benefits that all plans must have include services like hospitalization, maternity care, and mental health care. Furthermore, no plan can make you pay a copay for accessing preventive services like an annual physical or checkup or a mammogram or a blood pressure screening or any of those kind of things. If we make preventive services more accessible, we can keep more people out of the hospital longer and more of people from requiring expensive care. Again, that's our goal. Now, everyone will get an added sense of security because we are finally, aside from these new protections, we're making available a new public insurance option. This is essential to bring down competition to private insurance companies and to bring down costs for consumers. In most areas of the country today, including ours, one or two insurance companies dominate the market, and that means fewer choices and higher costs for consumers. We certainly know that in San Luis Obispo County. With a public insurance option, there will always be a competitor in the market interested in lowering costs. And this is going to keep companies honest and fair and competitive. Since everyone will have to carry health insurance, it is very important to make sure an affordable option is always available. This option will be designed by the Department of Health and Human Services. It will be subject to all of the consumer protection requirements I just listed, like every other plan, and it will exist as one option and only one option for you. Let me be clear. No one will ever be forced to buy insurance from the public option plan, but you will have the choice there if you want it. This is what the bill says. This plan will work like other companies in that it will be self-financed with funds collected from the costs of the premiums, though it will get a startup loan from the government that will have to be repaid. Payment rates for health professionals will be negotiated by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. And in order to build a strong network of providers, we will start with the providers who accept Medicare today, though they will be able to opt out if they do not wish to participate in the public option. I believe that a robust public insurance option is the only way that we know of to ensure true competition amongst the private insurance plans. People will try to scare you into thinking that private insurance will not be able to compete with the public insurance option. This is simply not true. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has estimated that when this plan is up and running, starting in 2013, approximately 10 or 11 million individuals may end up choosing this public insurance option. But the private insurance companies will add to their rolls another 16 million individuals in addition to their current members. So they will certainly be alive and well and running. The public option will keep the private companies honest and encourage them to provide you with better care and more affordable premiums. So now that we've covered how everyone will access health insurance, but we need to discuss another topic. The system will only work well if everyone has access to quality care. And how will we do that? We're going to improve Medicaid coverage, or Medi-Cal coverage, first of all, so that any individual whose income is roughly $14,000 or less may access it. We will protect additional benefits that are provided to people in states like California's. Medi-Cal will pay physicians more so that beneficiaries will have access to more health professionals. And I was proud to pass an amendment to ensure that nobody on Medi-Cal has to forego preventive services, preventive care, by prohibiting copays for those services. In fact, we're going to encourage better preventive and wellness care for everyone. This bill makes tremendous investments in state and local public health infrastructures. We'll have new grants so that communities can implement innovative programs that best fit their populations. And there are many of these here in San Luis Obispo today, but they're overstretched and they have waiting lists. So we want to make these kind of public health options more available. These could include initiatives to increase physical activity or reduce tobacco use. We're going to enhance the advisory committees that research and disseminate the best practice information about preventive care. And we're going to improve access to prevention and wellness services through the expansion of community health centers. Again, something that will be a great benefit to many folks here in San Luis Obispo. As a nurse, I'm particularly excited about the provisions in this bill to strengthen our healthcare workforce. After all, we can't improve the quality of care for all Americans without ensuring that they can see a doctor or a nurse when they need to. So we're going to invest more in programs to help train our next generation of primary care professionals, like physicians, physician's assistants, and nurse practitioners. We're going to have more loan repayment and scholarship programs for people who go to practice in underserved areas. And we're going to encourage more community-based training programs. Now, how about seniors? I've been getting a lot of questions about how this bill will affect seniors. And if you're a senior, 3200 will significantly reduce prescription drug costs for seniors in Medicare. Medicare will be protected and improved to guarantee that it is always there for you. And that's not something we can say absolutely today. We need this legislation to keep Medicare alive and well. Nothing will interfere with the relationship you currently have with your doctor. Beneficiaries will no longer pay copays for preventive care. Medicare will be improved because we're investing more resources toward fighting fraud, waste, and abuse. Medicare Advantage plans, which are provided by private insurance companies to begin providing care at lower costs, and the government will begin providing coverage at a lower cost, and the government will stop overpaying these Medicare Advantage plans. Health providers will also benefit from a new payment structure, one that rewards quality, not just quantity, and one that improves reimbursements for primary care and the time you spend with your patient. There will be innovative programs like the promotion of regional cooperation where health professionals in a community, doctors and nurses in hospitals, work together to improve care and bring costs down. Some of you have heard of the Mayo Clinic or the Cleveland Clinic or other communities where this has really happened and has proven to be cost effective. And the promotion of the medical home model, where every patient has a sort of home base to keep track of communications between all their health providers. We have also included a specific fix that I worked on for physicians in California, one that particularly benefits physicians practicing here in San Luis Obispo. It ensures that reimbursements in places like this one are on par with other counties with similar costs of living. It's one of the reasons we can't keep doctors in our area, is because the reimbursement rates are so low. That's being addressed specifically in this legislation. In other words, more physicians will want to practice here because, of course, they'd love to live here, and they will be reimbursed at a better rate. Another concern I hear a lot about is how this bill affects small businesses, and I don't blame them. 55% of America's smallest businesses can't afford to provide health care for their employees as much as they would like to, and insurance companies charge smaller businesses higher premiums than larger businesses for the very same benefits. So we've taken several steps in this bill to help small businesses out. There will be a permanent tax credit to help businesses with fewer than 25 or fewer employees and averages wages of under $40,000 a year to provide health insurance to their employees. Most small businesses will be exempt from the general employee responsibility requirement of providing health insurance to their employees. Those with payrolls less than $500,000 per year are completely exempt from the requirement of providing health insurance. And those with payrolls between $500,000 and $750,000 pay a lesser fee for not providing health insurance for their employees. So contrary to what you may have heard, small businesses will not be shouldering the burden of costs for our health insurance reform. In fact, they will be getting a lot out of this legislation. There will be a surcharge on the wealthiest 1.2% of Americans. But 96% of small business owners will never fall into this category. For small business owners, the surcharge will only be on net profits over $350,000 per year per couple, or $280,000 for singles.
And of the 4% of small business owners who fall into that category, most earn less than one-third of their income from these small businesses. Again, small business will do well under this plan. Now that I've covered what this legislation will do, and thanks so much for bearing with us, I'd like to clear up some misconceptions that exist. There are a lot of rumors about what's in the bill, and I'd like to dispel some of the most common ones. First, nobody will be forced to join or purchase the public insurance option. It will simply exist as one choice among many others. An employer could never force their employees to use the public insurance option. The choice will always remain with the individual. This bill actually takes steps to end the rationing of care that is practiced today by so many insurance companies. And we make sure that you are not denied access to life-saving care by limiting what you will pay out of pocket so that costs can never be too prohibitive. But decisions about your care will always be made by you and your doctors, not by the government, nor an insurance company bureaucrat. Out of all the rumors and misinformation, the one you see today, this now and on your screen, is the worst. It is simply untrue, and I believe it's a disservice to our seniors and to our doctors who work so hard to help their patients. This bill has a provision to provide reimbursements to physicians if they choose to provide counseling to their patients who ask to discuss so that more resources are spent providing better care, not paperwork. For example, we are reducing overpayments to drug companies and insurance companies that, according to independent sources like the GAO, overcharge the government by hundreds of billions of dollars. We're trying to make sure that your tax dollars are being spent wisely. Again, another one, this bill does not extend government benefits to people who are undocumented, period. This law will be enforced. And people who are spreading this rumor are just doing so in order to bring the rest of the bill down. I can point you to the exact place in the bill where this is discussed. And here's another one. I've been confronting this question about coverage of abortion because of an amendment I passed during my committee's consideration of this bill, and I'll tell you why. First and foremost, we want to make sure that current law remains in effect and no taxpayer dollars will be used to pay for abortions, except in the case of rape, incest, or a threat to the life of the woman, as is currently in law. What my amendment does do is to say that no plan is required to cover abortion services, and no plan is prohibited from covering abortion services, just as long as those services are paid for with privately collected funds. Everyone who buys an insurance plan in the exchange will pay at least some of their money to purchase that plan. That's what this shared responsibility is all about. And it is from those funds that any reproductive or abortion services would ever be paid for. More importantly, and this is the reason I introduced the amendment, the health reform debate should not be the place to debate abortion policy, as important as that policy is. And I work to find a middle ground approach so that we could concentrate on what the bill is about, which is health care and insurance reform. Okay, now, finally, health plans covering all federal employees, including members of Congress, will be required to follow all the same rules and regulations as all other employer-sponsored health plans. And that's in the bill. Now, how are we going to pay for this bill? The bill itself is deficit neutral, and that is something that the CBO has determined. And now, excuse me. Let me tell you how this will be done. We will pay for reform through improvements to make Medicare and Medicaid more efficient, which will yield us, according to estimates, over $500 billion over the next 10 years. We'll do this, we'll help to pay for this legislation by promoting more efficient care, not duplicating so many of the services that are done now. And we will add a surcharge on the highest 1.2% of earners. And we will curb loopholes that allow corporations to use offshore tax havens. Okay, finally, what does this legislation mean for the Central Coast, for our communities? In the congressional district I represent, the 23rd District, as many as 15,700 small businesses will qualify for small business tax credits of up to 50% of the cost of providing health insurance. That should make a difference. The 4,100 seniors who live here, who fall into the Part D donut hole, will see costs for brand name drugs reduced and eventual elimination of the donut hole. The new health care surtax would affect only 1.5% of taxpayers in this district. In addition, 148,000 people who live here and currently do not have health insurance will receive coverage. As you can see, this is a comprehensive bill, and I really do appreciate your bearing with me. To recap, these are our goals: to make sure that the health insurance you currently have is always there and is affordable, that we can get everyone insured, and that we begin to slow down the increase in healthcare costs. This is a topic I've worked on my entire tenure in Congress, actually throughout my entire life as a nurse, as a school nurse in our communities, to see that healthcare can improve for everyone. And I'm proud of the plan that we have come up with, and I'm thanking you now for listening to me and looking forward.
Holy place. And to be in the company of great women like Lois Capps, Jane Voights, Joyce Ellen, it really is an honor. It's a good fight. And thank you for championing this bill. Thank you. I'm not a lobbyist. I'm not an analyst. I'm not a representative of any group or organization, for that matter. My words today to you stem from my experience as a grassroots emergency physician here in this community. I'm one of those guys who rolls up their sleeves, goes to work, and takes care of people that come into our department, not because they want to come there, because they have to come there. When I look at the faces here in the audience, I actually see a couple that I recognize from having taken care of in the past. I trained at UCLA down in Los Angeles, and when I was there, I founded a free clinic, the OMA Free Clinic in South Central Los Angeles. You remember Florence and Normandy in 1992? Yeah? Well, we're two lights up from there, so you know the area. This was the epicenter of the riots in Los Angeles. When I was there, I was the medical director. I volunteered as a medical director while I was a resident and an intern. And when we opened our doors in 1996, we thought, you know, the people thought we're going to be taking care of homeless folks, we're going to be taking care of drug users and alcoholics. But actually, the people we took care of are the working poor. They were the engine of this country. They're the people who go out and work. Tell you a story about one woman who was a working mom. She came to the clinic with a fungating breast mass. I had never seen anything like it. In fact, you'd have to go to some third world countries to see something of this. Dr. Kuntz, who travels to other countries, is in the audience. I'm sure he's seen things like this from a urologic perspective. But you don't see things like that here in the United States very often. And she only had come to our clinic because the stench from her rotting breast, her coworkers were saying, God, do something about that. Go and see somebody. And this woman, of course, didn't make it. She was too late for any help. But bills like this one, $3,200, if it was in place, she is a woman that would not fall through that crack. You know, I have worked in several regions of conflict, like a couple of the other doctors here in the audience, areas of natural disaster. And one interesting thing you'll find is whether it's Kenya or Kosovo, there's one attribute that stands out very strongly about Americans. If you ask people, what do you know about us? The thing they'll say is that Americans don't leave people behind. When two Americans were taken in North Korea, Laura Ling and Una Lee. Do you remember this? Right? Our ex-president traveled across the globe to negotiate their freedom. Two Americans. When Captain Richard Phillips was taken by terrorists off the coast of Somalia, they took him, they were threatening to kill him. We sent a destroyer. Millions of dollars of hardware we sent across the seas to save him and to punish the people that did this to him. In my opinion, this is patriotism. This is patriotism. There are some of us that would reduce patriotism to a little metal flag that we'd wear on our lapel. Patriotism is a lot more than our love for our flag. Patriotism is a lot more than even our respect for our borders, from Alaska down to the Gulf of Mexico. Patriotism is an allegiance to our values, and it's an allegiance to the 300 million people that reside under the auspices of this flag. That's patriotism. So when you're looking at this bill, we're really questioning, what is our concept of patriotism? Some of you may disagree with me, and you have that right. This is a great country. Okay? It's a concept of not leaving one American behind. Okay? And we're faced with 47 million Americans who are without health insurance. 25 million Americans that are underinsured. Okay? Grossly underinsured. And if some of you might say, you know, well, this is them, that's them. I'm really kind of worried about number one. I'm worried about me. This bill is not just for them, it's for all of you. Do you realize that any one of us is one ailment away from bankruptcy? All it takes is one of us to get sick, and that includes me. This bill protects us from many things. It protects us from unfair practices of the insurance companies, of the insurance industry. It protects us from the nightmare of being thrown into abject poverty, and there's probably somebody in here who's been through this, of being thrown into abject poverty because of... Standing up? Okay.
Doctor, we need you to wrap up.
Okay. Sorry. Well, you know what? I'll close with a couple of...
Area Agency on Aging.
Thank you very kindly. I am pleased to be here this evening, and I am pleased to share with you that seniors in our community, seniors who are associated with the Area Agency on Aging, are supportive of H.R. 3200, and let me tell you why. This is important legislation. I don't speak as eloquently as the doctor does, but it is very important legislation. Medicare is an important piece of legislation from the 1960s, and it needs to be modernized. It needs to be improved, and 3200 will do that. Let me just give you a couple of examples. First, we're all familiar with the donut hole in the prescription drug plan. We need to eliminate that donut hole. It is a catastrophe. It causes people to stop taking medications, to just do inappropriate things because they can no longer afford to both pay the premium for the drug to the drug companies as well as to pay for their drugs during the donut hole. That will be changed in this legislation. Good. Next, this legislation, as Congresswoman Capps has reiterated, will address the issue of preventive care. Flu shots, mammograms, bone density, cervical screening, all of those types of things that we need to have done will not have copays. The earlier people have these things done to detect, the better our health, the better our outcomes. And the longer we can enjoy our retirement, our golden years, whatever that is to you. I think that one of the things that we need to recognize, and I heard a lot of rustling during this part, is that people seem to be skeptical about the potential savings that can happen in Medicare. And I want to say two things. First, as the director of the HICAP program, the Health Insurance Counseling and Advocacy Program, every day we see people in our office and in our counseling sites who have been denied care by their managed care insurer. Needed care that if they were on Medicare, they would be receiving that care. It is good in this legislation that insurance companies will be required to pay out 85% of the premium monies received. That is all very good. Second about this is that the GAO, General Accountability Office, has released several studies in the last several years that talk about the overpayments to the managed care. There are tremendous savings to be secured by reducing the overpayments because they are estimated to be anywhere from 12 to 19%. This is real money that can be saved and used for patient care, not for profits in the various insurance companies. So I think it is really important for us to step back and look at the legislation. 3200 is a good piece of legislation. Thank you, Don. And I want just to encourage all of you to read the bill. If you are an older person... Yes, there is a doctor in the house and he's coming. So let me urge all of you to seriously consider supporting H.R. 3200. It's a good bill for senior citizens. It's a good bill for Medicare beneficiaries. And I urge you to support this. And I want to thank Congresswoman Katz for her work to make this bill as good as it is. Yes, we need more. And we will continue to work for more and more improvements to our health care in this next decade and the next decade after this. But this is a great start in the right direction. Thank you.
Okay. Well, we want to very quickly get into your questions here, and I just ask that in the interest of getting as many of your questions answered as possible and to do that in as civil a way as possible, we want to be respectful of the questions, whether the questions are supportive or challenging, and so I ask you neither to cheer nor boo on the question or on the answer, just trying to get the information to you as honestly and directly as our panelists can offer it. And I'm going to work with what are the topics that we're most frequently asked about. Some of these were questions that were turned in before your presentation, Congresswoman Capps, so I think some of the things you have addressed, I'll try to pick up.
Faster than the rate of inflation, and they don't seem to slow down. So what is the way of their private enterprise? How is it that we can have health care, which means so much to each of us, be affordable? How can we hold these insurance company costs down? There are other times to talk about the topic of tort reform, and that's one piece of it, but that certainly isn't, I'll just have to wait until you stop and it'll mean less questions. We want to address the cost of health care and insurance costs. I asked the Secretary of Health and Human Services when I had a conversation with her directly, I said, why do we need this public option? She said, we could either regulate them to control, which is the government a heavy hand on them, or we can do what is in the American spirit, which is to provide competition to them. There are so many places like San Luis Obispo where there are very few private insurance companies operating. So they have free rein to raise their premiums. There's not much anybody can do about it. The public option will exist as a nonprofit alternative, following the same rules and regulations in the exchange that every one of the other private plans will have to follow, be self-sufficient, have to raise its own fees from premiums, but its goal will be to keep the costs as low as possible, not to provide profits for its executives. And hopefully that will stimulate some competition in the private market. So people here who have a private plan that they appreciate and like because their doctor uses that plan can keep that plan and they will and they will be more it will be more affordable. That's the reason for the public option. And I will support a bill that in the House of Representatives that has a public option in it.
So which again let's not make every question a referendum here by voice. I think that'll just really disrupt the ability to get more questions answered. There's actually interesting questions that are coming here on the public option, sort of two different sides. Some people being concerned about unfair competition with private insurers. Another person saying we pay $14,388 a year in health care premiums. We're 62 years old. Will the public option cost that much, or is it going to be less? So there's people who are both saying, hey, how is this going to save me money? And also, is it going to compete unfairly? You spoke to that a little bit. Do you have some further comments about estimates that have been made by of how this is going to play out?
The amount that providers receive under the public option will be very similar to what the private plans offer. The Secretary of Health and Human Services will negotiate a price. We're going to start with the list of Medicare providers because all of the private option. Now, again, bear in mind, this doesn't start till 2013. So it'll take some time to get everything in place. But the private insurance policies that you might have or that you know about all have their provider lists there. That's oftentimes why we choose an insurance company because that's where what our doctor offers or that's what our place of employment offers for us as well. So we want on the beginning of the exchange when all of these options will be in the market, we'd like to have the public option be ready to go. And we'll start with the list of Medicare providers because most people know who they are in the community. Now, as I said, they don't have to be in that plan. They can opt out of it, but at least there'll be a list to start. And their salary, their reimbursement, will be somewhere between what Medicare pays and what the mean or the middle of what the private insurers, what those doctors get paid. So it will be, it's designed to be fair, to have to stand alongside the private plans. Otherwise, it wouldn't be fair, and it wouldn't give a good competitive nudge to it. We really do want to make this a more American system, more competitive, free enterprise at work. And so the public option, it'll go out of business if nobody signs up for it. And if the private plans lower their costs because they are afraid that they'll be under, that they'll not be fair in competition, then that's achieving the goal that those of you who have private insurance would like. And so that's what we're going to start with. And the people who will enroll first are not folks whose employer already sponsors them a health care plan, who are paying into the plan along with the beneficiary. We'll start with those who don't have health insurance. They'll be the first ones who are given the opportunity to choose either the public option or the many private options that they'll have. Because those are the people that we want to get insured so they can start paying into the pool, which in itself will help to bring the premiums down for the rest of us. And then after a certain number of years, then it may be that, and this decision hasn't been really set, whether everyone will have an opportunity to get into the public option. Let me address one other...
Come into play.
There is a lot in this legislation, but there are so many things problematic in healthcare. That's one of the reasons that it had to be a very comprehensive bill, is because we have a problem of not enough providers in this area, not enough doctors, and certainly not enough nurses. That's one thing that had to be addressed. That's one aspect of the bill. We also have the cost of the health insurance. We have all the people that are not insured, and their cost for care when they end up having to go to the emergency room is expensive. You know who pays for that, don't you, in the end? Taxpayers do. So we're paying already, in addition to our own health care costs, we're paying for people without insurance. So moving this along and moving it into something that will work is important. At the same time, we have the government already involved in health care, don't we? We have the government involved in Medicare. And a lot of people forget that that's a government program. And frankly, And frankly, it is in danger of not being solvent. And so we've got to fix Medicare at the same time. It needs to be...
So let me jump into that next
yes.
category of questions, because I think that the second largest category of questions was in fact around the issues of Medicare and whether this legislation would have an impact on Medicare and what's happening with Medicare. So rather than having folks shout out their concerns, let's go to the questions that they asked here. And maybe we can try as quick answers as we can on this, because we've got a bunch
sure.
of other categories too. One person's asking, if part of the funding comes from Medicare, is that not a cut in Medicare? And will you promise not to vote for H.R. 3200 or for further legislation along these lines if any funds are taken from Medicare to do that?
I'm going to ask Joyce to talk in a minute, but let me be really clear, and this was mentioned in the talking points before. The cuts to Medicare are in the area of waste, fraud, and abuse, not services. Not services. Anyone who has, most people who are receiving Medicare know that there's waste in the system. There is waste in the system. And this certainly...
Well,
certainly we can...
We've got the questions, and we've got some follow-up questions on this topic, so please... No, I have to be very clear. As we outlined at the start... in order to get as many, make this an informational session rather than just a shouting match, the questions are provided in writing, and we're asking them to be answered. And we encourage you to provide whatever comments you may have on the comment form, whether you agree with the Congresswoman or not, or if you have an alternative solution to these issues, please write it on that sheet, and we're going to proceed with the next question. So
I actually would like, if you don't mind, Don, I'd like to give Joyce a chance to talk on this topic because she knows Medicare very well.
Thank you. Excuse me. CMS, Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, has been doing a number of fraud efforts during the recent years, and they've discovered major frauds, and they've been able to make significant savings. They want to expand these efforts. There's tremendous potential to eliminate fraud and waste in Medicare. Tremendous. Second, as I mentioned earlier, and as the Congresswoman has mentioned, there are 12 to 18% of the payments made to managed care are clear overpayments. That is a ton of money. There is money to be saved in the Medicare program. It can be reinvested right back into the Medicare program for preventive services and some of these other things that need to be done. This is a win for Medicare beneficiaries.
This might be a quick follow-up question for you, Joyce, since you know the local programs. Do you think programs like Secure Horizons would remain slow under H.R. 3200? In other words, a program that's for seniors, does that still work in this legislative environment, or would there be...
Secure Horizons is one of the managed care organizations, and I, given the estimate of the amount of profits that they make, I would think it's very likely that they're still going to be here, even if their payments are somewhat reduced.
Okay. And then please discuss the 21% cut in Medicare reimbursements. I'm not familiar with that. Do you have some information about that?
No. Okay. Based on the current formula, physicians in the nation are scheduled, it's a physician schedule, would be slated for a 21% reduction in their reimbursement nationwide. And in this legislation, that would be eliminated. You may recall a couple of years ago, Congress, again, the formula for the physician reimbursement rate is a little bit
solvent. It's to increase the reimbursement rate in areas like ours so that we can keep doctors here and we can keep the services provided to seniors and keep seniors healthy in an area like ours. So that is a particular remedy that is very much in the interest of those of you who live in San Luis Obispo County and Santa Barbara County as well.
Okay, let's go to the next major group of questions, which are all around the single payer, asking why is the single payer approach not on the table. You might take just a brief moment to explain what the single payer is if people aren't familiar with that. And then will you make sure that states can opt for a state-run single-payer system if they choose?
Thank you. We have a number of constituents here in San Luis, well, throughout the congressional district, who are very firm advocates, maybe some in the room, for a single-payer option for health care. And that is where the government, if we don't have health, private health insurance, we have the government providing health insurance for everyone, or Medicare for All is another version of it, I guess you could say. And that is something that I do not support. I appreciate those who do. I'll tell you why I don't, and I'll make it very brief. I believe it is too great a leap for us to take at this time with all of the many challenges that we face in health care. The way Congress works is very practical. The only bill... Just a second. I hear a healthy dose of skepticism, and I agree. But what I mean is that it is very much a give and take, a compromise. Some people have said the way Congress works is like you make sausage, and you never want to see that process. It is a back and a forth. And so the only bill that is in law is one that can pass the Congress and that the president will sign. A single-payer plan would not pass, and therefore, if that amendment is added, I've already told Anthony Weiner, who's going to offer the amendment, that I won't support it because I don't want it to kill the bill. But I will support the Kucinich Amendment, which was Don just referred to, which says that any state that chooses, and it's been there's been a movement toward it in California, too, any state that would choose the single-payer option would be honored under the health care reform legislation 3200. So that's the way that topic stands. I don't know. Okay.
So let's... you touched on this very briefly, but there's a couple questions that came in that wanted to explore this a little bit further, and that is, why isn't tort reform included in this legislation?
And now I am going to ask Dr. Cotter in a minute, but thank you. I know that has come up. It came up in the beginning. And actually, you know what? We do need to deal with this. It is a huge issue for physicians having to pay such high insurance premiums. And it's something that, as you saw how long it took for me to walk through this bill, a big bill with almost 1,200 pages, a big bill. If we had added tort reform, it would have taken a lot longer because it's a very controversial issue for the federal government. We've never undertaken to deal with state insurance policy before. But what we did in the bill is that we passed an amendment in the one that will come to the floor. We'll include an amendment that makes grants available to states so that states who wish to provide an alternative or to explore alternatives to the medical malpractice liability laws that they have in their state could use the funds to do that, to come up with some alternatives. Actually, California, and maybe Dr. Cotter will speak to this, has done tort reform. We did it through our car insurance. We have MICRA. And so we don't have as bad a situation for our medical malpractice as some states do, where it really is egregious. So it's checkered. It's not even among all the states. But in many cases, one could say that part of the cost of health care is due to the high premiums that so many physicians have to pay. I'll just make a one statement is that, you know, if you've ever received maltreatment from a provider, you want to have an opportunity for redress. You want to have that. That's the caveat to the reason that we do have that opportunity for redress. But I know we have a doctor sitting right next to me here who's been practicing, and I'll let him speak to this topic.
All right. Sorry, I was absent for a little while there. You know, it's an interesting thing. I think there's in California, there's somewhere around 115,000 physicians. Now, on these various issues that are coming up, I'm sure there's going to be differences of opinion on some of these issues. But I think probably one thing that we're probably pretty united on is the issue of tort reform and the need for there to be some medical malpractice reform. You know, when you look at some of the great medical minds in our country, specifically, concern about litigation. If you had concern about litigation in deciding the clinical management of a case, would it change your clinical decision tree? And 93% of those people answered yes. So this is kind of this, you know, in my opinion, it's kind of this problem that's underlying the system that nobody really talks about. And I think malpractice reform is key. That's going to be a harder fight than this one. Thank you.
We've got a bunch of questions here that really relate to cost, and people wondering how's this all going to work out cost-wise. You know, how can you really make sure that overhead costs are reduced? How will cost increases in healthcare be reduced or prevented? How can you ensure that there'll be good negotiation with the drug companies to lower costs? Some of the things that you address, but I think people have, you know, residual questions about how is that going to work out and how can you really get those benefits that are being sought?
Let me take a stab at it. And the cost of healthcare today is one worry, but many people are here tonight because they're worried about the cost of what this legislation might entail as well. And I don't blame you. It's a big bill. And we want to make sure that it's clear what we are planning to do and how we can how I could possibly say a thing like we want the bill to be deficit neutral and have you feel like that's a credible statement. So let's talk about some of the things we can do. And I think we have some comment that could be made by our panelists as well. One of the things I'd like to say at the outset, we can't afford not to reform healthcare. The cost of business as usual is way more prohibitive than the measures that we are undertaking to provide this health reform. And that has actually been substantiated by studies. We are on a pathway that the doctor has alluded to with the kind of medicine that's being practiced and the kind of insurance that people have in the private sector that is, frankly, unsustainable. We have people have said, why do we do this now? Let's fix one piece and then another. We have so many problems that are dragging our economy in addition to our recession. That if we don't, and that's why the president sees this, he really doesn't need another thing on his plate. But he knows that if we don't get health care under control, there's no way we can bring our economy really back to where it should be. So it's kind of one of those things we have to walk and chew gum and sing and dance at the same time. We have to really try to do this. And that's why I appreciate so much your patience in bearing with us and that we will pursue to answer your questions. Like education, this legislation is an investment in the future. We do have to pay the startup costs, for example, for getting a public option so that we can help the private insurance companies lower their costs. We can pay for some of this legislation by redirecting overpayments now going to drug and insurance companies. We don't need to be doing that. We don't need to be subsidizing them any more than they're making the profits they're making. We know that we can promote more efficient care. We know we can do that. We need more oversight so that we do things more efficiently in this country. We're paying more than any other country for health care, and we're really not getting our money's worth. So it behooves us to do some things about it. The nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office has determined that the pieces we've put in place will provide that this bill is paid for. One of those things is a surcharge on the top 1.2% earners. And yes, that's a tax, but they already made off pretty well during the last 8 years. In fact, the entire health care bill costs less than the Bush-era tax cuts for the wealthiest few. So, you know, we have to keep in mind that there's a perspective here. We've neglected reining in these costs for a very long time, and they've only gotten worse. I'll just stop there and see if my colleagues here have a comment to make as well.
Well, I think the skepticism is inherent in all of us. I mean, government. But when you look at the current fact that 16% of our gross domestic product is spent in health care, and the projections, including Medicare, require significant change. We need to look at reining in costs that are proven to be waste and fraud and other overpayments. Medicare has proven that it can be done. We need to just expand those projects beyond just the, you know, Los Angeles area and the Miami area, and really make some progress in cutting costs. It is possible without cutting the quality of care.
One of the things that's coming up in the questions is the concern about the flip side.
Our lady that just got ill outside, when she shows up at an emergency department, and that's crowded with people who don't have insurance, who don't have access to care, who don't have a primary doctor, well, guess what? Mom's going to have to wait, okay? And for me, that's not acceptable. For me, that's not the optimum solution, okay? And for me, I think what we need to do, are things like this, where these patients have primary care physicians. They have somebody to go to. There's an open door for them. It will reduce the number of people that are coming into our departments. And quite frankly, on the area of physician recruitment, you care about this area. Well, you know what? We just added 5 physicians to our group in Sierra Vista and Twin Cities. Okay. Why? Because we need to meet the increasing need in the county. The increasing need. And you know what? Those 5 physicians, it's difficult to recruit physicians over the course of a year when the reimbursement in this area is so low. Right? The average physician comes out of medical school with $150,000 in debt. It's an average. I know you don't care. Okay.
But these are
issues that recruitment of physicians and meeting the needs of our people, which is not just San Luis Obispo, but is this state and this country. Thank you.
Don, I've got a bunch of questions left on the table here that I want to be sure
I know
to
you
get
do.
To.
Let me say one word. The word children has not even come up in the discussion tonight. Because it did in your question, I just want to say we started out on our health reform thanks to the insistence of Americans across the country who said, we want our children covered. And we passed, and one of the first bills that President Obama signed into law, if you remember, was the state's children's health insurance bill, SCHIP, or Healthy Families, as we know, in California. And that bill is in place, so virtually all children under 18 are already covered. That's a model now we'd like to see for their parents. Thank you.
Okay. So we have a couple questions here about the capacity of the system to take on the new people that would be covered. How can the government ensure enough doctors and nurses to accommodate an additional 45 million people? Will the level of care be reduced as a result of this? And what's being done to increase those healthcare professionals?
I have to jump in here because I worked on this topic of not enough nurses, not enough doctors the whole time I've been in Congress. Being one of 3 nurses, you know, I feel like I really have a point to make about the shortage of nurses, and boy, do we know that here in San Luis Obispo. We have fine programs at Cuesta, at Allen Hancock, and other places, but they get snapped up in other opportunities, and so we need more medical providers. That's something that won't wait till 2013. We've got to do it now, and we will, and our bill does that. We know we have a huge shortage of primary care physicians. We need doctors and nurse practitioners and health physicians assistants who will work out in the rural areas, who will work in hard to serve areas where people haven't seen a doctor for a very long time, so people won't have to drive so far to get in, even in an area like ours, to get to care. And so we're going to start out in this legislation by loan forgiveness. That huge cost that Dr. Cotter mentioned of going to medical school, if we'll make a deal with doctors, if they want to go into primary care, we'll forgive their loans if they'll go to serve for a time in an underserved, hard-to-serve area. That's written into the legislation. That can start on day one. Same goes for nurses, nurse practitioners. We want to increase primary care so everybody here in this room can feel like they have some kind of medical home, if that's what they choose, so that they won't have to wait till they get so sick, and which specialist is it, and who do you have to call, and all, so you have a place where they know your records and where they can help you sort things out. That's our goal. That's one of the ways that we can hope to get this going.
Okay. We've got a couple questions here that relate to small businesses and employers. One broad policy question, then another question that is related to it somewhat. Why should health insurance be tied to employment? And then a question that asks, if our self-funded employer-based insurance votes for less coverage, will this bill require minimum standards of that employer?
Yes. First of all, we started out, if somebody knows medical history more than I do, I think it was after the Second World War we wanted to have health insurance and tied it to employment. We now see that maybe that wasn't such a best idea, but that's the program we have, and there's no need to really change it if we can make it work more efficiently. We want to make sure that all employers can provide coverage to their employees. That's the problem with small business. Big businesses, large businesses with a big overhead have an easier time doing it, although some of them are frankly struggling too, and they'll be appreciative of the fact that the premiums can be kept down because they'll have less copay or less matching funds that they have to put into it as well. So there's something into it for all segments of the business community. But small businesses have really struggled because many employers, some maybe in this room, really want their employees to have health coverage. You get a better worker if that person isn't scared to death that their kids are going to have an accident or school or some other thing and they don't have any kind of programs.
Then there's a question. Would you vote for an amendment to specifically exempt abortions from being paid for?
With taxpayer, the bill will not come to the floor. There is no legislation, and I wouldn't vote for it. If you want me to say it that way, there's nothing in the bill that taxpayer dollars are used to pay for abortions.
Okay. Now,
for any abortion.
Mm-hmm.
Except, well, the current law is in place that there are exceptions for rape, incest, and the threat to the health of, or the life of the woman.
Okay. A couple of questions here. These regard one here. If health insurance is required, what happens to homeless or other people with no income? And then a somewhat related question, will health care for illegal immigrants be covered? If not, why not?
Let me start with the last one. Section 246 of the bill specifically states that this bill is not designed for people who are not here without documentation. So no services can be provided for those who are not here with documentation. Now, the truth is that we do not turn people away at a hospital because of the public health ramifications and because of some of the things that Dr. Cotter talked about of who we feel we are as human beings and as Americans. And so we want people to be here with documentation, and this bill is designed for those people. And the second part of that question was? Pardon? Oh, you know, the programs that are in place already for SSI, for people who qualify for Medi-Cal, those programs will still be in place.
Okay. Now, there's a couple questions.
Dr. Carter, did you want to add?
Yeah, I was going to just say, you know, the saying, bring us your tired and weak. Well, that's what we take in the emergency department is everybody. We don't turn anybody away from our emergency services. If someone comes in with an emergency, we take care of them, and it doesn't matter who they are.
Okay. Good. Here's a couple of questions about the nature of this public option. Someone is saying that, you know, their parents and in-laws receive high-quality care with Medicare. They're wondering, will the public option give them an opportunity to buy a plan comparable to Medicare? They currently have a costly insurance plan that they feel is inferior to Medicare, and they would love to have the kind of benefits that Medicare offers. And then there's a question here about this public option. There are people wondering, can it really be cost-effective if it maybe people who have pre-existing conditions because they can't get care elsewhere might gravitate to the public option?
Let me start with the last one because I want everybody to be clear. The day the bill is signed into law, no insurance company will be able to deny anyone service for a pre-existing condition. That is one of the pieces of legislation that will go into effect right away. Some of the pieces I mentioned will take until 2013 before they start the exchange. But also denial, you don't have to pay a copay anymore on the day the bill is signed into law for preventive services. So if you've been waiting to have a mammogram, don't wait, please, go get one. But the legislation, the minute it's signed into law, that will take into effect that you don't have to pay copays anymore, whether you're on Medicare or Medicaid or a private plan or public option. Then you'll have those opportunities there for you. Also, for Medicare recipients, the 50%, while we're waiting for the donut hole to be phased out, the 50% discount on brand name drugs will go into effect right away as well.
Okay. We have time for a couple more questions, and we're almost at the end of the categories of questions here. So we'll try to get through these last few.
In other words, talk fast, right?
Right. In the interest of serving our public here. One question somebody has is, they say, from their perspective, why use a sledgehammer instead of a scalpel? In that person's perspective, 85% of the people are satisfied. Is this overdone? Is this doing too much?
I should let the emergency room doctor talk about scalpels. But let me just say, and the truth is, a lot of people, maybe it is 85%, are satisfied with the insurance company the plan that they have. And actually, I think I said that a number of times, you can keep your plan. But many of you, maybe not you in this room, but some people are very concerned of what would happen if they lose their job and they have to get another insurance plan, and maybe that company might find some pre-existing condition or something, or maybe they won't qualify, or maybe they'll get sick and they'll be cut. There's a term called rescission that insurance companies are using right and left to all of a sudden cut people that you would begin to feel the effects of or see the effects of here in our communities right away.
And this is a concern that somebody has about the current options that insurance companies have to define or restrict certain treatments or drugs. How would that change with this legislation?
Well, the one about pre-existing, a lot of that would change right away. Those egregious situations would change right away. The competition won't start, frankly, until there's some competition there. As we know here in this area where there are very few policies, private companies in place, that will continue. But some of the practices will be now not allowed to happen. And there will be oversight so that they will not be able to continue.
Okay, I think that we just have a couple concluding questions in the different stacks here. One person was asking, would you be willing to sign up for the public option yourself as you think it may shape up?
You know, I wouldn't be eligible right away because I have an employer-sponsored program. Many people are in this room. But let me tell you, frankly, as I've learned about it, I wouldn't mind it. I think we don't want a second-class program there. We don't want one that's overbearing and that we're trying to design one that works. It has a purpose, and we want it to be there. And there'll be a time, maybe if this all works long enough, where it'll be a choice that everyone will have. But all of the regulations that are going to be put in place in this legislation will affect members of Congress just like everyone else. Like I stand in line at the airport and go through security like everybody else, I am a person who gets health insurance, and I want everyone to have a good health care policy. That's what this legislation has about it.
Okay. We have two final questions here. This person says they're concerned that some health plans currently cover costs for Viagra, et cetera, but do not cover costs for women who need birth control medication. Will that change? How are these issues of what's in, what's out, and all get sorted out? And how will that be fair across the populace?
I don't think this legislation really goes into that much detail, although, in the interest of, one gender receiving more benefits than another, some of us have been concerned about the opportunities for contraceptives to be available, frankly. And I've put myself into that category because I'm concerned about many of our young people not being able to afford it, who really need it as well. But that's certainly a minor note.
We have a remaining question, and then I want to close for the evening. Meanwhile, as you're considering your thoughts and reactions to this evening's discussion and the responses to the questions that you raised and that your neighbors raised, I encourage you to fill out the comment form. Congresswoman Capp's staff will be available at the door to receive your comment forms so that she knows, upon your reflection of this evening's discussion, what are your thoughts, concerns, suggestions, as this legislation and other bits of legislation go forward. But this is a question about, you know, how do you eliminate undue influence that seems to be impacting some of these discussions, you know, with regard to the pharmaceutical companies or other special interests around this legislation? How do you deal with that? How can that be dealt with in the future so that people feel that this is a fair program for the public?
Well, I'll tell you, I was a member of Congress when the Medicare Modernization Act passed. I saw the number of pharmaceutical representatives who were on the Hill because they had a lot at stake in that legislation. I didn't appreciate that. Frankly, this legislation was written without their participation. They actually did sit with the president. They came to the White House, the insurance companies, if you remember, and the pharmaceutical companies, and wanted to participate. And that's, frankly, something that we haven't seen in any major reform effort in the past. I am concerned about the way some of the conversations have gone around the country lately. But in the end, you know, and maybe this will be my final statement, our system of government is not neat and tidy. It is a democracy. It's a representative democracy. And as you can see this evening, in this community and in all the communities I represent, and I dare say across the country, there are a very wide range of opinions and strongly held views. And when we can come together in a setting like this and have the kind of discussion that we've had this evening, you can go away you can go away from the evening satisfied or dissatisfied. But you have been patient. We started a little bit early, and we are running a few minutes after. And I want to make sure that you know how much your participation means to me. That now, and I'm happy to discuss it further with the person again. But again, my wholehearted thanks to you for coming this evening and for your interest in this legislation and in healthcare reform. I want to give my partners here a chance to say a final word, too, if you don't mind, Don.
Mm-hmm. You want to start?
You go right ahead.
Okay. Well, thank you very much for hosting us. Once again, I think these issues are close to my heart because I feel that this type of legislation will actually make a big impact on the lives of all of us, and not just the few that people talk about as being left out, but actually every single one of us will be given a safety net. And I think that is just a huge, huge thing. And my hope is that, you know, our elected representatives will be working together to really come up with something that's going to work. Thank you.
I want to join with my panelists and the moderator to thank you all this evening. It's a terribly important topic for older people. Healthcare is probably the most important issue that we face to make sure that people have access to good healthcare. So in closing, I just want to encourage you all to read, review, be informed, and we'll make some progress with this legislation, and we'll still have more to do to make sure that our country is able to provide and ensure good health to all of its citizens. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Well, I want to thank Congresswoman Capps, Dr. Rushdie Abdul-Qadir, and Joyce Ellen Lippman for their comments and responses to your questions this evening, most of all to you as our audience. And certainly thank the United Methodist Church for being the host for this event and the League of Women Voters for so honestly and candidly bringing your questions forward so they could be responded to. So we thank you very much and encourage you to leave your comment forms as you depart so that the Congresswoman will know exactly what your thoughts are. Thank you very much. Have a good evening.